This program was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, Irirangi Tumotu, MPR.
Listening to live and on-demand shows has never been easier on MPR. All you have to do is go to the App Store or Play Store on your device and search up Access Internet Radio NZ. Select and download the first option at the top of the list. Once you've downloaded the app, the next step is to open the app and look for MPR. Once found, select it and then browse freely. Supported by New Zealand On Air.
Are you a midlifer and feel it is finally your turn? Spent your years up until now taking care of everybody else's needs. Feel invisible when you have so much more to offer society. Then welcome to the Middlicious Podcast, the podcast where we talk about how to live a delicious and magnificent midlife. With your host, Nikki G, coach, author, speaker, and Middlicious Midlifer. Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Middlicious Podcast. I'm Nikki G, your host, and today I have Greg Watson with me. How are you, Greg?
I'm great. Thanks, Nikki. It's lovely to be here. Thanks for having me along.
Pleasure. Greg also has a show and a podcast on Manawatu People's Radio called Property Matters, don't you, Greg? You host that with Villy?
Yes, we do with Villy Tossie, and it's Tuesdays at 2 p.m. on the radio. As you mentioned, it's also a podcast, but we just talk about all things property.
Fantastic, because property is a subject dear to Kiwis' hearts. We're going to talk about that a bit later in the podcast because Greg has a lot of expertise in that area. But first of all, Greg, the first thing I do for guests is say, tell me a bit about yourself, because I know you pretty well and I know you've got a fascinating background. So fire away.
Yes, well, I consider myself a Manawatu person, having lived in Palmerston North for most of my life. In my younger days, up until probably around the age of 10, we used to move around a lot because my father was in the post office savings bank and got transferred. But most of my life, and certainly most of my adult life, has been here in the Manawatu. So we consider ourselves a Manawatu family. We love living here. We live in Palmerston North. I grew up and went to Milson School, St. Peter's College, and then went to Massey University. In between school and university, I actually went and lived in Sweden for a year as an exchange student studying in Swedish upper secondary school. Came back to New Zealand, finished my qualification, and around that time my father and brother were looking at opening a real estate company, and they asked me if I'd like to go in on the ownership. And I was about 22 years of age, so I thought that's too good an opportunity to miss, even though it wasn't what I'm qualified in. So we've opened the real estate company, Watson Real Estate, and we've been doing that ever since. Worked away for 10 years. I did an OE for about 18 months and went back to Sweden and worked in a psychiatric hospital. Many of my friends suspected I was actually a patient, but I can assure you that I was actually doing some work over there. And then come back and continue with the family business. So that's generally a bit about me. I met my wife when I was about 30, and we got married a couple of years after that. And I have two children who are 10 and 11.
Wow, 10 and 11 now. Wow. So what was the attraction with Sweden? I hadn't realised. I knew you'd been to Sweden for an OE, and I knew you'd worked in the psychiatric ward, not in, as in you worked on it, not in
it.
It
wasn't a live-in position.
You weren't a live-in position. So please, it's been stated there on the Middlicious podcast that Greg Watson was not a patient. What attracted you to Sweden?
There was a few things that was quite interesting for me back then. I'm a reasonably adventurous type of person, and one thing that really appealed to me was the extreme cold and living in an environment for a long period of time that was really quite different than what I was used to. Growing up in the North Island, we didn't have that experience of extreme and prolonged cold, and the things that come with that, skiing and ice skating and just the day-to-day living, held appeal. Another fact was I like the intellectual challenge of learning another language, and even though Sweden's not a language that's widely spoken, it was challenging and a lot of fun to learn. And subsequently, that's why when 10 years later I did my OE, I went back to Sweden, because I felt, well, it's good just to keep challenging myself and learning in that way while many of my friends were going to the UK. As well as that, the Swedes are the tallest and slimmest race in Europe. Just a bit of trivia. And at the time, I was 17 and a young man, and the blonde Swedish woman was part of the attraction. I try not to say that was the first reason.
Okay, we'll believe you. We'll believe you. Is that still true? Because I know Swedes, there is the stereotypical Swede, which is tall and blonde.
Yes.
Although I understand, I remember watching something recently that said there were actually more brunettes in Sweden than blonde, so that kills that myth. But are they still the tallest? Because, I mean, there's a lot of enlarging people in the world today. So are they still tall and slim?
I would say they'd be there or thereabouts. They do lead largely fairly healthy lifestyle. Mm. Sweden has experienced, since the early 1990s, massive immigration. And so a lot of people from the countries in Europe that are, or from further south, Africa or the Middle East, they've experienced a lot of migration. So it's really a melting pot now rather than the stereotype that we could possibly picture in our minds.
Like every other country now,
exactly.
Isn't there? A lot of Western countries. So when you were in Sweden, did you get to see Norway and Finland and Denmark and all around Scandinavia?
Yes,
and
I did a bit of travel, and it's a beautiful country over there. I mean, there's thousands of lakes. There's a real one thing, of course, is the extremes in climate, but as well as that, there's the extremes in the amount of daylight or lack of daylight, depending on the time of year. So you could go north and have 24 hours of sunlight in the middle of summer, and that was great because that coincided around about with my birthday every year. So that was lovely. You could have a barbecue and sit outside all night long because it actually doesn't get dark. And then in the winter, it was very, very dark, and you'd maybe around lunchtime, you might get a little bit of twilight for an hour or so if you're in a job.
So that fascinates me because there is a thing called seasonal depressive disorder, which we talk about in wintertime when people don't see the sunlight. How does that work in a place like Sweden where you might get it for an hour a day?
It's much, much more noticeable in the northern countries, and the north of North America and Canada find this as well. Interestingly, the psychiatric hospital I worked in had a special unit to treat people with the seasonal affective disorder. And what it does is the disorder itself, it's a little bit like depression. It's a lack of sunlight, really, is what triggers it. But it really gets you down. And even living in that, it can be quite tough. So they had these rooms in this hospital which had no windows, but they had this diffuse light. I couldn't even tell where the lights were. And it was like you're in the middle of a nice sunny tropical day. And so people would come in and they would sit and get the light or whatever the vitamins or that they need from the light. I'm not a biologist, but that would make them feel a lot better. So in my duties, occasionally I would sneak in there for half an hour and you'd come out feeling great.
I think it's vitamin D we get from the sunlight,
yes.
Greg, from memory.
Yeah,
and because we don't think about that. Also, too, I was really fascinated what you said, that you like the idea of extreme cold, because
yes.
We complain about the cold here, but we don't get cold here in Palmerston North. We get damp,
yes,
but a lot of New Zealand's very temperate.
Yes,
and you might get some what they call hoar frost down in Canterbury.
Absolutely,
where
yeah.
They're cold for days. But, you know, you get into Russia and you get like minus 40 degrees.
Yes,
were those the sorts of cold you were dealing with in Sweden?
Yes, it depends a little bit from year to year. But one year in particular, we had a prolonged period around about negative 30 degrees Celsius. And the interesting thing is it's not a damp cold. Once you get to about minus 4 or below, the cold feels very similar. It's just whatever effects it has on your body or on other aspects of the environment happen much quicker. I remember once that we were in a car and the front headlight went out, and we decided to – it was dark, of course, because it was winter. So we pulled in to a service station to effectively just open the bonnet, unscrew the light, take it out and screw another light bulb in. Very simple operation. So we stopped. It was minus 30. We'd take our gloves off. You'd start fiddling around trying to get a little bulb into the car, but your fingers are slowly slowing down. And within a minute, you could no longer move your fingers. And I remember it took us three attempts. We had to go and talk to the service station attendant inside each time for 5 minutes to effectively be able to use our fingers again. So you do have to be careful. Another thing that was really interesting when comparing to New Zealand was I lived on the shores of a lake about four times the size of Lake Taupo. So a big, big mass of water in the summertime. It's very similar climate to New Zealand summer, so there'd be sailing and water skiing and all those fun things, fishing. But in the winter, There was up to 12 feet of ice. And if you just take a moment to imagine 12 feet, it's like concrete and you could drive cars on it.
Wow.
You could go for walks. You could even ice skate for scores of kilometres. And so really, really different.
How fascinating. Because, I mean, Lake Taupō doesn't really get like that, does it, I think? Because we have the thermal activity there as well.
Yeah, that's right. And just the incredible amount of ice on the surface is really something else.
Well, 12 foot of ice, more than double the average person, so that's incredible. So you went to uni, did you go to Massey University?
Yes, I did. I went through Massey University. I have qualifications in psychology and also in computer science. So I was looking at designing computer systems for businesses. I know it's a strange combination, but I was looking at designing bespoke computer solutions for businesses. But that was 4 years of study, and about in the fourth year, I decided it wasn't really being true to myself in terms of my personality, which is quite outgoing, and I love being around people. And this looked like several years of just straight out computer programming before I could get anywhere. And so I was at a little bit of a loose end when I was asked to go in on the running of a real estate business, which I had no experience of at that time.
So did you complete your degree?
Yes.
In computer science?
Yes. And psychology.
And psychology. That is an interesting combination because they are, one is very people-based and one is very technology-based.
Absolutely.
So I would imagine, though, if you had gone on further with that, you could have maybe designed some amazing apps that
Absolutely.
You think about it. In my field, you know, there are coaching apps out there that I think are quite clever. But
yes.
Fascinating, because psychology is a fascinating study.
Absolutely, and it's such a huge, huge topic, and it actually crosses over a lot with computer science, things like apps or artificial intelligence, robotics, potentially.
Artificial intelligence is huge at the moment. I think there's a lot of fear around AI.
Yes,
robots and the thought that – but it's going to happen. I mean, we've got self-driving cars now. It'd be interesting. I can't imagine being in a self-driving car because I'm a control freak. But I guess if everyone else is the same, I wouldn't like to be the only self-driving car on a road that has – especially New Zealand roads, because we have a terrible road toll.
But. Yes, imagine us two in 30 or 40 years' time. When the robotic cars, the self-driving cars finally come in, we'd just be glad to have a way of getting around, I think.
That's very – actually.
And let's face it, if it crashed at that stage, well, I've had a good life.
That's a really good point, because my mum at 84 has lost her licence, and it's a massive loss for people because it really does keep them isolated. So if she had a self-driving car, it'd be interesting to know. You have to talk to Elon Musk. I know he's really – ironically,
Absolutely.
Anti-AI.
He yes, I know, isn't he?
Feels that, you know, the American government are naive and there needs to be. Because what was that movie, that Will Smith movie, Robots?
iRobot, yes.
Where the robots took over.
Yeah.
So you fell into your profession. So tell me, because you've got a real estate company, but you are the property management arm.
Yes.
Was that how you originally started? Did you originally start in real estate?
Yeah, originally it was a case of a three-man operation as such. And so my start into the industry was really based around administration and behind the scenes while the others were selling, etc. When you have a real estate sales company, what happens over time often is that clients ask you to manage rental properties. We did that for a while, not myself personally, and then we employed somebody and we grew that part of our business. However, a number of years into our operation, that person was dismissed. It was an instant dismissal situation for theft, unfortunately. And this person was stealing a considerable amount of money, luckily not from our clients, but from the owners, myself and my brother and father. So that was instant dismissal. And that person, you live and learn in life and in business, and that person was in sole charge of property management. You never do that again, but nevertheless, you live and learn. So I thought, well, that's a great opportunity for me to try and take something that's growing, build up some knowledge and expertise, because I like to feel like I'm constantly improving and progressing, and I felt this is a great thing to do, and really got into it that way. It was literally, who's going to do this? And it was like, I took a wider view of it rather than, oh, no, I have to do this. It was, this looks like something that could be really great.
So how long ago was that, Greg? How long have you been doing the property management side?
Myself personally, probably, I'd best guess, probably about 17 or 18 years
now. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So are you in midlife? You can't be far away. I was thinking about you.
No, I am in midlife.
You're over 45 now.
I was very diligent. I did my research and I looked up what the age limit was. So yes, I am. I'm happily heading into midlife.
Yeah. Happily heading into midlife. It's quite interesting because I was listening to a podcast the other day and he said midlife was between 45 to 65, yes. or 70 now because we're living so much longer. But he also talked about the malaise of midlife often starts a lot earlier, and that's quite an interesting thing to think about, I think, because people are striving so much that they hit a crisis in their life where they just go, I don't want to do this anymore. So are you happy with where your life is at? Is it where you expected to be? Did you have any plans of what you wanted it to look like? Or how are you sensing at midlife? The very beginnings of midlife, I'll just throw that in there.
Yes, Greg. Yes. I'm generally a lot more content than I used to be with where I am. I was constantly, when I was younger, I was always wanting to improve and to be better. And within my working life, I started to win awards, including regional, national and international awards, because I was constantly striving to be the best that I could in what I do. And that was something for me at the time which helped drive me onwards. And that was to my detriment somewhat, because every time I won an award or I had some success, I wouldn't dwell on that. I would just simply think what's next and what's next and what's next. And after a number of years, that becomes an unhealthy way of living your life. And I think when you can reflect back, or you get to an age where you can reflect back a bit, I don't regret it. I've had a wonderful, wonderful life, but I'm now in a position where I don't prioritise in terms of putting pressure on myself, being the absolute top or the best or that sort of thing. The drive for me wasn't so much setting goals around things in work. It was more around just constantly wanting to improve. I've got to the stage now where I'm one of the experts in Australasia in my field of property management, and that feels really nice. But I don't I'm not – how shall I put this? I still drive myself. I still have a drive to constantly be better, but I'm more relaxed about it these days. For example, I've started – soccer refereeing in the last few years, and I always want to improve, whether it's fitness, whether it's techniques, whether it's they have levels that you progress upwards, so just wanting to progress up those levels. So I still have a drive to want to feel like I'm making improvements, which I think is in a way is partly a human thing. And I think that there is a risk in midlife if you feel that there's nothing more you can do, or the best days have gone, then I tend not to dwell on what's gone. I've had a wonderful time, but this is a new chapter, and I'm really enjoying it, despite my body being a bit older and my mind still being young.
I love that your body's a bit older, but your mind's still young. There is so much in there. For a start, for those who are international, by soccer he means football. I think America's the only country where they call it soccer
isn't
it?
Yeah.
We had to get our head around that because for years, when we were growing up, they called it soccer, but now I've got my head around the fact it's football. It's really interesting what you said, because it's something I see with clients, and it's one of the risks of goal setting. Is that if there's a mismatch between goals and values and everything, then there's a lovely term, I think Wayne Dyer used to say, that you're always striving, never arriving. And yes. I think that is a malaise that I think probably contributes to mental health issues, because we do need to celebrate. One of the things I say to people is you've got to celebrate when you achieve something.
Absolutely, and I never used to. And then after a while, I figured, you know what, you do have to take a step back. See, people used to tell me, congratulations, fantastic, well done, that sort of thing, but I never used to take it on board because I was too busy worrying about the next thing. And whereas now these days, I do celebrate, and I might pull over on the side of the road just after doing my day-to-day job if I've done something good, and just take 30 seconds and say, well done, instead of just rushing to the next appointment. I have We Are the Champions on my playlist, which if I do something good at work, or if I'm happy about some success, I play that, and it just helps me to think, yeah, you know, you've done well. Because sometimes you can be achieving and achieving well, but it can become almost like the norm. You have to remind yourself, actually, I'm doing all right here.
I think Tony Robbins used to talk about he needed to be achieving to be happy, and then he realised that he could happily achieve. And I think that's quite a different psychology. I think too, you've got to check in all the time, and you haven't implied this, but I know I've seen it in high achievers, is how much of their identity and their self-worth comes from those celebrations and the awards and you know, and that's a bottomless pit, because there's going to be a day. It's funny, I was at rugby this morning, and we were talking about the All Blacks, and the All Blacks, you know, the most successful sporting franchise in the world. And we were actually talking about the Crusaders in the weekend. For those of you who, in New Zealand, we have Super Rugby, and Crusaders won for the 10th time.
Incredible.
And it is incredible. Mm. You know, but there's a point too where they, one is people get disappointed if they lose, but we need to lose. And we need to fail, because yeah. I think we learn a lot from our failures and our, you know, the All Blacks. It was. I remember Ireland beat them twice, I think.
Yes.
Which was pretty amazing, because I'm part Irish, so I loved that. But also too, that just to remind people, they're never going to win all the time, because if your self worth is dependent upon awards and things, there's going to be times when you don't win the award.
Exactly.
So does that mean now you're not worthy? And that's the trap people get caught up in, I think, Greg.
Yeah, it can be quite a vicious thing, because if you don't win, you can be hard on yourself and move forwards, whereas no one else is being hard on you.
No.
If you do win, then really there's going to be someone else that wins next time, or you can't be at the top forever. You know, sports people, they probably get to a stage and their decisions would become a lot earlier than some of the rest of us, where they might be in their 30s and suddenly everything they've always done and always known is changing and has to change. So that's where you can liken that a little bit possibly to middle age. If you've worked your way through a certain career and then you want to have a change for whatever reason, it's like starting again, and that's pretty daunting. Luckily, I'm very passionate about what I do and I love what I do, so I don't want to have a change. I love helping people. However, you can see how that, you know, with sports people, if they're constantly saying, I've got to be at the top, got to be at the top, what would that do to your internal feeling of self-worth if you no longer were at the top and you were just a, you know, somebody passing by somebody else on the street? It must be tough.
Yeah. Well, we were watching Wimbledon the other night, and there was, I think, Rafael Nadal was playing Alfred Zunga, I think his name was. And I said to Andre, wow, he used to be at the top.
Yeah.
That guy, but he's not anymore. And I mean, working in the professional sport field, it is brutal.
Yeah.
Absolutely brutal. Mm. You know, you're only an injury away from your career ending.
Or
if it's team sports, a selection or a lack of selection away. And it's not for the faint-hearted. And I think it's easy to sit back and look at professional sports people and go, wow, what a glamorous life. But they don't see the work that goes on behind it.
And you can see as well with high achievers, because they could be so hard on themselves, and let's take All Blacks, for example. I mean, you look at there's some big name All Blacks there who suffer depression, just like many of the rest of us, just from either putting too much pressure on themselves or whatever internal things they're doing. And it just shows you can get to the top of your field, but still not necessarily feel inside.
Well, Steve Jobs is a really good example of that. Clearly, he wasn't a professional sportsman, but he, you know, was known for his depressive bouts. And you know, they don't come much more successful than Apple.
That's right.
But even then, so that is the fear, I guess, around constantly striving. You know, when do we stop and go, wow, I've actually done it? Because I think, too, not only do you I think the awards and the wins become meaningless. And that's a real danger.
Absolutely, and that's where I know it sounds ridiculous, but it can be a bit like that for high achievers. And so what I've done in more recent years is put more value on personal relationships, and whether that be family or friends, some of the things that give you the other meaning in life, you know, so that you're not tied up in having to work yourself to death, getting the highest and best results and trying to be the best and necessarily even lead by example in that way. So much more relaxed approach now. The work-life balance is a bit of a misnomer, but I must say that I do spend more time with my family now and with friends and really enjoy it. And I was reflecting with somebody recently that you get to a certain stage in life and you start losing more people more regularly, of course, as happens with age, and you start dwelling on some of those things like, I really should have spent more time, and whether it's family or friends or even activities that you like doing. And so that's where I've been having some of those conversations lately with people that are maybe 20 years my senior, that where they've been saying, wow, it's, you know, it's a, the relationships are so important. So I think I'm in a much better place now than what I used to be in the valuing of family and friends, and really enjoying spending the time, not being distracted.
Well, at the end of the day, we don't take our awards with us, do we? It's the people around our bed when we're dying that I think. It's interesting, though, because that book, I just can't remember her name, who wrote The Five Regrets of the Dying. You know, the number one regret was that people didn't live their own life. They lived the life others. And yes, that was really mind-blowing for me, because that's why I do the work I do, to help
that's
people
incredible, isn't it?
Set themselves free of the binds of the opinions of others and go and do what you dream of doing. And it's one of the things I love about you, is that you've done that. And were you, though, with the awards, it was, to me, what you said earlier, it was more about the processes rather than the outcome. The awards just came. It was more about the processes you had to create to get to those awards.
Yes, the reasons that I entered awards even in the first place was not to win awards. It was to compare my performance with others in a job that I loved, to then help me to try and grow in a way to understand what I could do to do the best job that I could do for people in my chosen profession. So by entering awards, you get feedback around that. And I thought, well, that's a good thing to do. And then I guess once you enter them and have some success, then you think, oh, maybe I should keep working towards this. I should keep doing new things and keep trying to improve, keep entering those awards to compare. And then after a while, I think I'm the most awarded property manager potentially in Australasia, certainly in New Zealand. And it just becomes a journey. That's not to say I get hung up on anything like that anymore, but I still enter them for the same reason, which is, how do I compare? What could I do better? Or how could I move my business forwards?
So there's a bit of benchmarking going on.
That's where it stemmed from.
Yeah. There was a word, we've already done 25 minutes, Greg, so we've got 2 minutes, and then we'll but there's a word you mentioned, content. And I think contentment scares people, because they have this idea that if you're content, it means you've stopped striving, you've stopped learning, you've stopped. But I actually think that contentment is a better space to be able to do that from, because it doesn't have that urgency and that desperation that can sometimes come with striving.
And that's where I was saying, I guess I'm considerably more content than what I used to be, where I was never pleased. Whereas now I can sit back, I can be happy in my own space, in my own body, with the people around me, where I am in my profession. But that doesn't mean you don't still have a drive internally to say, well, hold on, I want to do a bit better job of this, or do a bit better. It could be anything, relationships, communications. But there's always ways you can improve. So I do agree that there is a risk in, I mean, if you're content, you're happy. And who doesn't want to be in a happy place? Mm. But there's always ways to try and improve life a bit.
I think contentment is an internal game, and I think happiness is an inside game. And I think you're far more likely to find happiness when you are contented.
Absolutely.
I think if you have that massive hole in your life that you just can't fill, and you're looking to external factors to try and fill it, I think that's not where happiness comes from. Listen, we have run out of time, so I'm going to ask you back, and we'll actually talk about property, which is one of the reasons is I know you have a great story and I always enjoy talking to you, but two, we want to talk about property. So where do people find Greg Watson? Where's the best way to look you up?
Actually, I'm often on Facebook. It's just on there, if you look up Greg Watson in Palmerston North, and I'm readily found there. Otherwise, Watson Real Estate, you could find your way through there to me. If you'd like to join me on Facebook, that's great. If not, you can just do some spying.
You do a lot of wonderful videos. You love the videos, Greg,
I
think, and I love the way that you do
that. Fun.
You do have to have some fun. So you've been listening to the Middlelicious Podcast with Nikki G and her guest, Greg Watson. If you want to find me, www.middlelicious.com, or Nikki at nikkigunning.com. So have a fantastic Middlelicious week.
Support this program and others like it by giving a donation to NPR. More details at npr.nz.